and welcome to another Tea with Nettie. Today's guest is John Wilson, with whom OAE has done two stunning Gilbert and Sullivan projects. And it was very, very interesting to hear his thoughts, because in some ways we're all miles away from each other, but at the heart of his philosophy is getting back to the intentions of the composer's score. And that is something very much at the heart of OAE's work as well. John specialises more in film music, greats from Hollywood, which he's actually reconstructed after the original scores were destroyed. He's actually took it, a lot of this stuff, down from dictation just by listening, which is amazing. But he also is a great champion of neglected music, with his particularly British music, with his Symphonia of London. He's been doing the most wonderful things, and several recordings, and of French music as well. Anyway, I learnt loads, and I'm sure you will too.
Tea with Nettie.
Well, I'm glad we made it work. Here I am.
Here you are, John. I'm very indebted to you so far. We haven't got very far yet, for coming all this way just to talk to me. And what fascinates me is you've obviously got an incredible ear for music. You take things down from dictation, or have done. There was that terrible story about the MGM, the scores that were buried under a golf course. Can you tell us about that?
Well, taking things down from records wasn't something I did ever for pleasure, but I did it out of necessity, because when I was a kid, there would be bands, you know, like my teacher used to play the piano in pubs and clubs, and this would be like in the early 80s for ballroom dancing, for social clubs and things like that, and there would be a pianist and a drummer and trumpet and a violin and a saxophone, and they didn't have any music. Or used to have these things by Jimmy Lally. They were printed on this tiny paper, and the idea was that they would work for any combination of instruments. So if you didn't have five saxophones and four trumpets and three violins, four players would still sound great. But even as a kind of 11-year-old, I found them sort of unsatisfactory, because I'd been listening to Frank Sinatra and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald, and I wanted the band to sound like them. So I started to listen to those records and try and write down what was happening. Of course, I did it very badly when I was like a kid, but I was fascinated by the possibilities of a group of musicians playing together, a band, an orchestra, and that fascination with those possibilities has never left me. So any music that I could get a hold of, scores from the library, I think during my teenage years I must have taken out every score that Newcastle Central Library had, you know. Wow. And Gateshead Library. But of course you couldn't get scores of the MGM film musicals, and because my background was largely untutored, there was nobody telling me what I should and shouldn't be listening to. So I kind of went for the things that I liked, whether if that would be Benjamin Britten on a Monday and Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds on a Tuesday. Mm. And because my mother would watch these films on a Saturday afternoon, I was exposed to these film musicals, and many years later I wanted to perform those pieces in concerts, because I definitely felt they should have a life beyond the celluloid. They should have a life in the concert hall.
In their own right.
Absolutely, because we're talking about music by George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Harry Warren, Irving Berlin, the greats. In the original orchestrations, it was when I discovered that much of that music, certainly everything that was ever written for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, had been destroyed, and I had to piece it back together myself. And it's a combination of applying yourself, just sitting down, listening over and over, and filling in the gaps of the things that you haven't got immediate access to. So I say that because piano scores, piano conductor scores, survive for quite a lot of the films. but they give you a limited amount of information. And what you haven't got before, you have to fill in. Sometimes you haven't got any scores at all, and you've just got to listen. And it's a question of just having patience. But it's kind of satisfying when you get to the end of a score and then you play it through in the rehearsal and you're hearing in the flesh the stuff you've only ever heard in scratchy mono.
It's come into multi-dimension again, reborn. I think that's incredible because I read that you, as you say, you were left to your own devices. You had access to your granny's piano once a week.
Well, we used to go on a Sunday to visit my dad's parents. And that was the first time I saw a piano. You know, I was three and I was obsessed with this thing. But yeah, music was always, I was always obsessed with it.
But you didn't learn to read music till much later. This is what I find so impressive about your going to the library and getting out scores.
The thing was, when I was 11, I saw this chap carrying a bass drum across the school car park. And I said to the school class music teacher, "Who's that?" And I said, "That's Mr. Robinson. He teaches the drums." And I said, "I want to learn the drums." And they said, "Well, we don't know if he's got any spaces." And so he took me on. And I think he recognised that I had some kind of aptitude, flair, whatever. And so I became a percussionist for the simple reason that there was an opportunity to do with music. And I'm not sure there were any other opportunities in that. When I was five, the violin teacher, the peripatetic teacher, came to the class and said, "Everybody have 2 minutes on the violin and we choose 5 people to study it." And I wasn't chosen. I was deemed inadequate. And so I remember that very vividly, thinking, I wanted to learn the violin. They didn't let me. And
when you were five and they just made that decision and that...
Well, I guess they didn't have 30 fiddles, you know, the only five...
Well, I suppose in retrospect, we're rather lucky that you didn't. You might have ended up with a solo violinist.
Well, I don't know.
You know, for the rest of us.
I'm obsessed with the violin, but we'll come to that later.
Yeah.
But I learned the drums because there was an opportunity. And in a way, I'm very grateful that I did, because it meant I could play in the youth orchestra, and then I could play in the dance band, and I could play in the shows. And so it kind of satisfied my enthusiasms on all the different levels. You know, I've never apologised for the fact that I love good, what we call light music. And if you look back, there was a time when light music was a part of every composer's life. Mozart, Haydn, Schubert,
Telemann, before that,
Handel, and I suppose with the advent of tourism and broadcasting at the early part of the 20th century, light music almost then becomes a specialist thing. People make trips to the seaside and they have hotel orchestras and they have bands on the ends of the pier, and that's when Sullivan and Edward German and Eric Coates and all these people come into their own and light music becomes a thing. But I think there's something really important about what we call light music, in that it was always music for everybody and it always had a direct and obvious appeal. And I don't think that discounts it from also being music of real quality.
Not at all, not at all. Actually, almost the opposite,
really. Well, I think that, but I have to say, when I left the Northeast to come to London, I remember I was playing for a choir or something. There was a little party afterwards, and I remember this lady, quite a grand lady, said, "I hope you're not going to play all of that rubbish when you get to London, because you'd be laughed out of the Royal College of Music taking all that nonsense with you." And I just thought,
oh no.
And I challenged her, "No, that's wrong. This is great stuff." And I've never apologised. I've always embraced it as part of everything.
Yes.
That I do. But to go back to your question about reading music, so I learned the drums, and of course that meant I learned how to read percussion notation.
Yes.
But my piano playing, such as it was always instinctive. I mean, I could always play the piano. I taught myself to play the piano when I was a kid, when I was five. I remember being 4 and a half and telling the music teacher at school, "Look, I can play the piano with 2 hands. I was 4 and a half. And she said, "Well, you'd better come and show me." Judith Wilkie. And she walked me into the school assembly hall with this yellow upright piano with a tapestry on the back. And And I sat and played the piano, and it made perfect sense that you should have a melody in the right hand and accompaniment in the left. And I could do that. And I always loved playing the piano, and it was always my hobby. Yeah. It was never something I wanted to do professionally.
Mm.
And when I went to the Royal College of Music, and I got second study piano lessons with Alan Rowlands, who later became a great friend of mine. From the word go, I said to him, look, I'm not even looking to improve my piano playing. Can we just play duets every week?
Oh.
Just what we did.
He must have been thrilled.
What we did for 3 years.
Because his second study pianist pupil must have been appalling a lot.
Well, it was a mixed bag. But eventually, my reading caught up with my playing, if that makes any sense. And that was through doing
piano duets when you couldn't stop, for a start.
You know, just being forced into it.
Mm.
And as percussionists playing in bands and orchestras, I just remember sort of picking it up as I went along. And by the time I was 15 or 16, I was here, there and everywhere doing stuff with brass bands. Brass bands were a big part of my childhood. I guess playing in the brass bands, you know, and working my way up to playing in the top section band at Everready was where I learned the most, the fastest, because it was the first exposure I had to excellence and a real drilling.
Yes.
We had Major Peter Parks conducting the band, who was the most famous brass band conductor in the country. I was terrified of him, and years later I met him, and he was this sweet, gentle soul. But when I was a teenager, I was scared witless of him, because
was
he
very
sorry,
strict with
he was
you?
Very exacting.
Mm, like you are with your band.
I suppose, yeah, I wanted to be right, he wanted it to be right, because the music, you know, it's what Nathan Milstein said when he was pressed for his philosophy, as much your philosophy as a violinist, and he said, well, the music's, I guess I just try not to spoil it, and the implications of that is that the music's perfect. You know, it's a modest answer, but if the score is perfect, you want to try and honour the composer, and that way, hopefully, you satisfy the audience, and that's our philosophy. The score is the Bible.
The score is the Bible. And for OAE, people who haven't heard you do Gilbert and Sullivan with us might be thinking, oh, what's the connection with OAE? But I think philosophically, we've always tried to get to our own truth, how we perceive the truth or the sound of the truth, to be by going back to manuscripts whenever possible and facsimiles. Because the editions over the years have just, they've done the most appalling things.
Of course.
According to the times in which they were done.
Well, that was the distinguishing factor of the two projects that I did with the OAE. The first opera being Trial by Jury, with a mixed sort of first half, and then Princess Ida.
Mm.
In both those concerts, we went right back to the source material. Mm. So there were no Dolly Cart alterations or traditions. And you know, there's a fine line between tradition and habit, and you have to scratch away to work out what is the real. Sullivan died when? 1900? In a way, G&S had flourished after that and was subject to so many alterations by many people. And clearly, if you're not Gilbert or Sullivan, you haven't got the authority to make those changes.
No, absolutely.
So we did go right back to the source material, and we used editions which had been painstakingly put together by people over at the Trial by Jury edition. Took years to make. I didn't do that. It was done by an American.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you're starting off, at least with the truth in the text,
yes,
it then, in a way, it frees you up. You're not asking further questions.
You're just being a detective, and you're just trying to work out what they actually wanted.
And you also have something you can't argue with.
Yes.
So that variable is taken away.
Unless, which is often the case with composers, they have come up with later versions of their own stuff. And sometimes I was just talking about this the other day, actually, with Max Mendelssohn. Sometimes, in the case of Mendelssohn, he thought he'd improved something, like with his symphonies, and actually a lot of people prefer the first versions, and then it becomes a little bit more personal. Or do you feel very strongly that one should always go back to the first one?
No, it's interesting. I'm just planning some recordings of Debussy at the moment, and I've been using the excellent editions that Baron Reiter have put together by Douglas Woodful Harris, I think his name is. Anyway, he has taken, in the instance of, say, L'Après-Midi, every source, and he's weighed them really carefully in the balance. And to me, it sounds as if it makes more sense. I think that's got to be the final arbiter, hasn't it? What sounds...
What works.
Correct.
Yes.
That said, his La Mer, which we've also just recorded, it isn't released yet, has a few marked differences. And a few of the players were like,
oh,
that's weird. I've never heard that before. Why are the French horns not playing there? And some people have questioned... I mean, there are definitely changes that Debussy made, and he may have made them later in life, but... Was it not because he was a bit bored with the piece, or...
Or maybe he didn't value the French horn players at his disposal for that at that particular time.
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't like to say, but I think if you're working from an edition and you respect the editor's approach, and the editor really does respect the integrity of the composer and all the materials, and they've done a really balanced job weighing up that sort of relevance of the source materials. What more can you do?
Yes, I was at the Royal College of Music with Jonathan Del Mar, and he was always very interested in that, and he's done loads of Beethoven.
I've read all of his books.
Under a microscope.
I actually love Norman Del Mar's conducting books.
Yeah.
I've read them all. Conducting Elgar in particular, it's like Bible for me.
Really?
Because they're so... useful, and they're so practical. And I guess I've always considered myself a practical musician.
You are. It's obvious you are. Yes. If you go from how it sounds and the nuts and the bolts, and you know how to make it sound right, you are practical. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Norman Del Mar, as it happened, he conducted the orchestra when I was playing in the Royal College of Music. He used to conduct us. He was absolutely priceless. If you asked him a challenging question, he'd say things like, "Oh, you have me on toast there." You know, things like that. He had the most wonderful turn of phrase.
But Norman's books are so full of authority and knowledge. And he taught my teacher, Neil Thompson, who was also taught by Maurice Hanford, who was Barbarolli's assistant. So I guess if I have a reputation for being thorough...
Mm.
For the want of another word.
Thorough rather than brusque or exacting. Thorough, yes, that's a good word.
It's, I guess, Barbarolli, the line is Barbarolli, Maurice Hanford, Neil.
That discipline.
Me. I just remember watching Neil's rehearsals and thinking, she doesn't let anything go.
Mm.
And it sounds so much better when he's finished. Mm. And I couldn't not follow that example.
No. Well, we had Vernon Handley, we were allowed to call him Todd, and he also conducted our orchestra. And he was like that, but he also was very, very funny. I mean, he had us in stitches half the time. You never quite knew. And we even had Muir Mathis. He came in, actually, once or twice. I can't even remember what we did with him, but I was there, you know, in the very early 70s at the Royal College of Music, so we did have some interesting people there.
That's interesting, because it was Muir Mathison who was responsible for the formation of Symphonia of London. He needed an orchestra for all these films he was doing in the mid-50s,
yes,
when he was doing a film a week. Extraordinary. How do you do a film a week? Well, you've got to write the music, and you know, he must have had an army of people working for him, because he's often credited as supervisor. So you'd have all these composers.
I suppose, like Hans Zimmer. Now, I suppose there, anywhere where there's a lot of money in it, people just flock to do it. There's never a shortage, is there?
But I remember that was my first exposure of seeing the name Symphonia of London was on those old films, and I'd see the credits. And then when I was 11 and I went to the HMV shop on Northumberland Street in Newcastle, I remember the first time, and my mother took me up to the top floor, and there was a whole floor of classical music, and I was like, it was like an Aladdin's cave. Because the only records I'd seen were like the few LPs that my folks had. And at school, there was a shelf of LPs, like Malcolm Sargent conducting the Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra and Peter and the Wolf and some. There was a Philharmoniac. I remember, I could see the covers. And then I didn't realise, you see, that you could still buy records, because these records were so old and dusty. I just thought, well, that must have been from a long time ago.
But then
my mother took me to the HMV shop in Northumberland Street, and there was this whole floor, and she said, well, you pick something out. And I picked out the Barbarolli English Music for Strings record with Symphony of London, simply because it had a photo of the orchestra on the front. The photo of that, the black and red record, and there's a photo of Barbarolli conducting. And Leonard Hirsch is the leader.
Oh, gosh.
And Ray Keenly Side is sitting in the first violins, because I know, because he pointed himself out to me. And that was what sparked my interest. Of course, when I got the record home and I played it, I didn't realise that it was a top flight orchestra, but over the years I knew that it had a special sound.
I was going to ask you about that. That sound imprinted on you like a gosling, and you really were excited by that sound.
I was, you know, in a funny sort of way. That orchestra then, back in the day, Symphony of London in the 50s, was the kind of English equivalent of the American studio orchestras in Hollywood. It was all the top quartet players and concert masters.
And a lot of emigres refugees.
Yeah,
I think that was one of the things, wasn't it, that informed that particular
Well,
sound.
If you think about it, the circumstances that led to a lot of those players being, say, in Los Angeles.
Same thing.
You know, it's exactly that. Many of them were not there out of choice. Many of them have been famous soloists and concert masters in Europe, but they fled to California to save their lives, to save the lives of their family. You know, Korngold supported seven families when he was in Hollywood. And he said publicly, Jack Warner saved my life.
Gosh.
But of course, what it meant when Korngold ended up in Los Angeles from Vienna, suddenly everybody in the music departments, not just at Warner Brothers where he was, but Fox and Metro, they were aware of it. A new level, a new standard.
Mm-hmm.
He was such an aristocratic musician, and he brought this incredible kind of talent with him. Mm-hmm. And you had an orchestra where you'd have Warner Brothers' eight first violins, all of whom were soloists.
Yeah.
And well, I guess that was the sound that I was exposed to as a kid, and I loved it, and it's never, my love for that sort of highly active playing.
Febrile. And playing with such commitment, as if their lives depended on it.
I've never lost that. Or that sound's always thrilled me. But that, I guess that's connected to the fact that I've always loved that sort of string playing, you know, individually. You know, I've got every record Heifetz ever made. I think, you know, Heifetz is still God for me, really. There's a kind of perfection and ardour in his playing that it's just, I don't think it can be beaten. And then I'm rabbiting on here, but when I got to the Royal College of Music and I met Andrew Havron, I kind of met my soulmate musically.
Yes.
Because he introduced me to this whole world. We'd be students and we'd be staying up at 2 o'clock in the morning listening to Michael Rabin doing double stops and things like that. And and Andrew could pick up the fiddle and play like those people. He could. I'd say, do your Heifetz, do. Yards from where we're sitting now, Andrew and I had a regular gig at Grosvenor House playing music in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And we played everything. Again, he would just shove stuff in front of me and make me play the slow movement of this violin concerto. I've probably never been as sort of a good a pianist as I was then. I'm not saying I was any good, but that was certainly my peak when I was just having to do the thing.
Well, you were inspired, weren't you?
Well, I just had to.
You were being inspired.
I was being paid as well to play the piano. And that gig got me through college. But Andrew could suddenly be playing a piece of music and then he'd suddenly slip into an impression of Ida Haendel or somebody. And he'd have me in fits. Because it was so accurate.
Brilliant.
And so meeting Andrew and then forming my orchestra, forming the John Wilson Orchestra with Andrew at the helm, you know, on my left-hand side for all those years.
Yes.
Right from the start in 94. Yes. Through all those early gigs and then at the proms and everything. That's a massive part of my musical identity.
It really is.
Huge.
And then, of course, because of the nature of what you were doing, you were working with singers as well. And did you choose your own singers?
Yes, I did.
Even
would
for
you
the
like
proms?
Some more water?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Well, yes and no, in that you always have an artistic committee at the proms. It was always a discussion. But I was always looking for singers who never condescended to the material, whose love for the material was really genuine. You can always tell.
You
that kind
tell.
Of sincerity.
And particularly with crossover, you can...
Yeah,
yes,
it's got to tell. Be... I was reading the other day in a book about the clarinet by Jack Bryman. He's talking about these Alec Templeton pieces, I think they were, and he says, you shouldn't play these unless you have a real knowledge of the idiom, because otherwise it's embarrassing.
Oh.
And he's talking about the sort of the light music, the swing idiom. And yes, it can be embarrassing if you're not steeped in tradition, you know.
Yes.
And I think...
So do you think he put off people who would have really liked to have immersed themselves into that just
to
see how it felt?
Or encourage them to... Or encourage them to get to know the tradition. I think that's a more positive way of putting it.
Yes.
I get lots of conductors who came to me and say, oh, can I play one of your MGM things, or can I do this and that? And I was like... Of course, I'm very happy to sort of, you know, I think it's really absolutely crucial we encourage young musicians to spend a lot of my life doing so. But make sure that you listen to all the right things first. Make sure that you really get to grips with the idiom, because there's no difference to getting the stylistic elements right in a Rodgers and Hammerstein number than there is in a Mozart piano concerto.
Mm.
Of course, within each of those disciplines, genres, there's room for you to express your own musical personality, but I think there are definitely parameters of style.
Well, you have to sort of put down some sort of roots in it, then.
I think so, because I was talking about this the other day at the Royal Academy of Music. If you've got well-ordered, disciplined boundaries, that actually frees you to express yourself.
Yes.
Whereas if everything's a free-for-all, well, then it's chaos. You've got far too many variables. Whereas if you say this is the style, this is the style of the bow, this is the style of the left hand, this is where we place things. There are basic functioning parameters of discipline, and within that we can make music. I think it's liberating.
I think so, and it's funny. I mean, my whole upbringing and introduction to music could not have been more opposite to yours in every possible way, you know, in that I was made to have piano lessons from the age of 2 and a half and told what to listen to, and blah, blah. You know, it's completely opposite to you. But when I got to the age of 40, I thought to myself, I really ought to learn how to listen to jazz. I don't know anything about jazz, and I'm going to enrol on a course. I enrolled myself at the Guildhall, where I'd actually been teaching a few years, to do an introduction to jazz course, and it was really fantastic. And my tutor actually was Robin Michael's father, Richard. Scott Stroman was running the. But I remember I'd always felt about improvising. I mean, I wasn't frightened about improvising in a Baroque or classical way, but I felt way out of my depth with jazz. And I always felt it was a bit like driving into an empty car park and not knowing where to park. And he said, I want you to take just these three notes over the 12-bar blues, well, the opening, the 12-bar blues, and just do as much as you can with these three notes, but just expand as much as you can. And it was the most liberating thing I'd ever done. It was really amazing.
And the connection between that and composing is interesting, because that's what you're doing, basically.
Yeah.
You're composing. I remember Richard Rodney Bennett, who was another really important influence in my life. His view of composition was that here's your cell of material, build an edifice. And when we worked on a film for the BBC in 2000, or 99, I think it was 99. It was the only time he ever used an orchestrator. He asked me to orchestrate this film, and it was a huge score.
That was a lot of trust he showed in you.
Well, we'd known each other quite a while by this time, but it was like 2 hours of music. It was a huge thing.
Wow.
And he built this entire 2-hour edifice on two short themes, short cells. And more recently, since I've started, I'm involved in a big project with Shandos, the BBC Scottish, recording pretty much all of Richard's concert music. Okay. 4 volumes are out. We've just recorded volume 5. Gosh. And the thing I'm struck by the most is that he'll take a tone row, or he'll take a short motif, and he will work that material in so many ways to build something completely coherent and a rich variation, and the way that he can use the material to, in so many different ways. I'm always impressed by that. But again, it's as you say, it's discipline, and when you've got your 3 notes, and it comes back to this thing of giving yourself anchors, whether that be in performance, whether it be in writing music.
Yes. And who did he study composition with?
Ooh, that's very interesting. I think Howard Ferguson, although have been his piano teacher, but famously Boulez. He was Boulez's first student.
Wow.
In Paris. Richard started the Royal Academy of Music in 1953. I think. But Richard could do it when he was 15. It was just like prodigy, really.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a massive influence on me, because we thought the same way about music. I guess his thinking didn't have any boundaries in terms of genre. That was the first thing that we...
artificial boundaries. He just
common. He was kind of the original crossover artist, to use a well abused term. But he could do it all. He could write an atonal symphony for Darmstadt, and then he'd be playing jazz with singers in America.
And you also had lessons with Joseph Horowitz.
Yes, he was my main teacher for all the years I was at the college.
Lovely.
4 years. I consider myself incredibly blessed to have been around him. You know, I miss him. I miss picking up the phone and talking to him, because he was a person of such quality and integrity, and he never opened his mouth to say anything unless it was worth saying. And he was real old school, and I mean that in the highest sort of possible way to compliment him. There was so much hard-earned knowledge there. I once talked to him about, how did you become a composer? And he said, well, I didn't know I was a composer. He said, I just had such a thorough training at Oxford, and we would do these exercises, like write the fugue, write 16th century sort of counterpoint, and suddenly all of these exercises had built up all of this musical muscle, and he found himself a composer. You know, so, but I guess that sort of rigorous training allied to a kind of natural talent.
Yes.
And Joe's musical personality also chimed with mine, in that he was a kind of fiercely intellectual classicist on the one hand, but loved the dance band music of the 1920s and 30s.
Yes.
And so I felt, well, if he's allowed to like all of that, then it sort of legitimised my thoughts, gave me the confidence to carry on ploughing my own.
But had you been lacking in confidence? Were you not just following your instinct?
I think when I got to college for a while, I did feel like a fish out of water, definitely, for a couple of years.
Because, and is that because of the social milieu where a lot of them had come from?
But also just everybody was like, kind of like, strictly doing, inverted commas, classical music.
Yes, I see.
Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of profs who definitely thought I was wasting my time. Weirdly, one of them, I'm not going to tell you who it was, but one of them wrote to me shortly before he died, and he was a very nice man, a great musician. He said, I just want to write and say, I'm sorry, we got it wrong. And of course, he didn't have to do that, because...
Oh, that's nice,
They didn't get it wrong, but they were a bit sort of like, well, you know, we don't do that here, we do this here. I mean, it was a long time ago, 34 years ago. But I never felt discouraged, because I had Joe. And I had Philip Wilkinson, who was a great supporter,
yeah.
you know, mm. once a week. And with Neil, my conducting teacher, and Alan playing piano duets, I had a very supportive environment. I learned everything I know at college. For me, because I was so far behind when I started, I travelled
yes,
a much
trajectory was
you know, longer journey than a lot of my.
But a lot of it is luck, isn't it? People sink or swim, yeah. and if you do find even one teacher who has faith in you and understands what you're doing, it makes such a difference.
I always sort of leapt out of bed in the morning full of enthusiasm for music. So there was all that energy and all that enthusiasm. It was just a question of channeling it, and that's what my teachers were really good at.
Yes.
They could see that I was full of questions, full of curiosity, getting excited about everything, and they helped sort of focus. And Joe was great at that. Mm. And
do you fulfil a similar role at the Royal Academy now?
Well, I'm not at the Academy very often. I only go in to do projects. I love going in there. The standard of the musicians is absolutely sky high. Some extraordinary players. And I was there last week conducting Scheherazade. I still try and get him to reach for the stars.
Of course. Yeah.
There's lots of idealism. Let's not make it good enough. Let's make it as good as it possibly can be. And they give me a full week to work with them.
That's fantastic. And I'm sure you're spotting people. I mean, I remember when I was at the Royal College, I was more or less parallel with Simon Rattle, who's at the Academy, and he was getting his Mahler symphony together, and I remember there was quite a buzz. And
I mean, it's an interesting thing to mention, because I do keep my eyes and ears open for players for my orchestra, and crucially, the players in the orchestra who are well-established also recommend people to me. The principals of each section are highly involved in who else is playing. And it's got to the point now where it's kind of set and settled. But with any orchestra, you're always going to need extras. And I think ultimately you end up with an orchestra where everybody wants to be there. That's the ideal thing.
Yes, of course.
And that's what I think we have now, an orchestra where everybody wants to be there. Everybody's full of beans when they turn up.
It goes both ways, because if you want to be there, it's because you feel you are wanted. It's a two-way thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's another sort of dimension of fitting, which I'm not interested in players merely fitting in. I want to have an orchestra where everybody feels they can be themselves and be really, not passive, but really active in their playing and really contribute. And I think it comes back to what we were talking about parameters. Yes, we have parameters of style. We don't waste the bow. We go for a concentrated string sound. The left hand's alive. All these things, lots of articulation, dynamics. I'm crazy about dynamics. But within those borders, everybody can be themselves.
Mm.
They have absolute freedom to contribute. So I hope nobody ever feels stifled or diminished in any way, because I'm always encouraging personality.
But not frightened of making a mistake. Coming in early
No. I always say, if you come in early with real conviction, I'll buy you a drink. Because it means you're contributing and you're
adding.
There's
that famous story, who was it, Norman somebody, that violinist? I'm sure you know this story, but in a rehearsal, somebody came in wrong at the back of the first violins, and after the conductor said, "Norman, you're fired," he said, "Why, anyone could do that? No, it's how you sounded when you played it."
Oh, terrible.
There's so many of those wonderful jokes. Yeah, so with OAE, to sort of pull you back to this gritty thing, you mentioned, I think, that you'd be quite interested in doing some Offenbach with us.
I was looking at all of these French operettas, and actually French operas, you know, Massenet and others.
Oh, yeah.
Because the great revelation for me when we did the Gilbert and Sullivan, actually, yes, it was a revelation, but it was also the reason why I wanted to try it in the first place, is instruments have changed so much over the past 100 years. How would this process of doing opera with gut strings, wind instruments of the time, tiny trombones and cornets, calfskin timpani, all of that. How would that materially affect the balance between the orchestra and the singers? And it was an absolute revelation. Now, bear in mind that we weren't even in the pit. We were on stage at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, where balance would be even trickier. And I had so many people come to both those concerts, and not a single person said they couldn't hear every word and everything, and the singers never had to force. And then, of course, it got to my thinking, what would Orpheus in the Underworld sound like, or any of those. I did Cendrillon of Massenet at Glyndebourne. And I just don't know why this music isn't played as much as it used to be. You know, Beecham used to play it all the time, and the level of invention is so high so much of the time. So that's definitely in my sights. But as you know, pulling these projects together with choruses and singers and orchestras and rehearsals and finding the right way to present it takes a lot of time.
It does take a lot of time, I know.
And I'm so grateful to Crispin for letting us, particularly with Simon Buttress, do it the way that we felt it should be done, giving us the green light. And
well, he really wanted to do it like that, and it was brilliant that we managed to involve Acland Burley students.
Yeah, with their great costumes
and all sorts of things.
He brought the thing to life.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
It was marvellous, really memorable. And I think when you do a concert like that, which is an event, and it had such great feedback, and one of the things that kept coming back to me was people had been brought up with Gilbert and Sullivan, but it sounded fresh, it sounded slightly different, and that was purely about chiselling some of the barnacles off it and going back to the source material, which is a thing we keep coming back to, because it's a central pillar. You know, I'm recording all the Eric Coates music at the minute with the BBC Phil in Manchester, which is music I've loved all my life. I knew his son very well. His son gave me access to all the surviving manuscripts, and 32 years later I'm still working on these editions, going back to the source material, and we're on volume 5. And I mean, who thinks about Eric Coates? He was a commercially successful light music composer in the first half of the 20th century. I think he was the highest paid British composer. His music became ubiquitous, and it would be very easy to say, oh, that old stuff. But you know, the orchestral players of the era, he was always referred to by those players as the master. And Elgar, no less a person than Elgar, described Eric Coates to Beatrice Harrison as a genius. He said, I think Eric Coates is a genius. And he had a standing order with the HMV on Oxford Street. Every time a new Coates disc came, they would send it to Elgar. And he loved the Summer Days Suite so much, he wore the groove out in the LP that had to send him a replacement. Okay. Well, I tell you what it is. I think Charm is a really underrated, it has no currency at the moment, Charm. It's an undervalued commodity.
Yes.
And Coates' music has charm and it has sentiment.
But of course, we listen to Coates now with our 21st century ears. We sort of heard almost every possible combination of notes and rhythms and everything. And it's when people hear Corn Gold and think, oh, it sounds like film music, and they don't realise that that's the wrong way round.
Well, exactly. Well, that's exactly what Previn said. Somebody said, doesn't Corn Gold's music sound like Hollywood? And Previn said, no, Hollywood sounds like Hollywood. Didn't have a sound until Corn Gold got there. Exactly. Max Steiner, to be fair, was there just a bit before Corn Gold, but
we're so much afterward that it's very easy to lose the progression and see how things happen. And people watch TV advertisements and recognise something because it's used for that, and sort of out of context.
But if that gets people into listening to music, then it's all to the good. It's making sure that everybody has the access.
Well, I know, but there are limits. I mean, I heard the Mozart Requiem being used for women's panty pads or something the other day. I thought, really? Look, there has to be a limit.
But you know, just to mention Corn Gold, it's really great that here we are in 2024 and he's now a mainstream composer.
Yes.
And I remember in 91 or 2 going to my Monday morning lesson with Joe Horowitz, and he had a cassette and he played this constant nymph. the film soundtrack, The Continent of Congo, this great big epic tone poem. And he said, who do you think this is by? And I was like, Strauss? Mm-hmm. Mahler? I hadn't a clue. And he said, no, it's Congo. And of course, after that, I devoured everything. But nobody knew. Of course, people knew who he was. But the violin concerto was considered a sort of a novelty. And now the violin concerto is in everybody's rep. It's a shame Congo never lived to... He died a broken man because his music... He'd never gained the acceptance that he formerly had.
That is tragic, isn't
but, you know, it ties in with what you just said about how we listen to stuff now, as well as having sort of heard, as you say, everything. But when enough time has passed, the good stuff does float to the top.
That is true.
It never vanishes, the stuff that's worth hearing.
It's the same with paintings and art, isn't it?
And I think Congo was probably the most unfairly neglected of the significant composers. I put that out there.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if there's anything else. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that we haven't got onto?
Well, not especially, but I think just going back to the OAE, I was really nervous when I went in for that first rehearsal.
Cause what, with OAE?
Yeah, because I thought...
The very first time ever?
Yeah, I thought... I felt like a complete sort of fraud and a phony because you have all these experts who come in who really have dedicated their entire lives to historically informed performance practice, and I haven't. And I was like, I thought they're gonna find me out straight away and this is gonna be a disaster.
It's so funny.
And I actually found it to be one of the most open-minded, engaged, really inquisitive groups of people that I've ever worked with, which is why I was so happy to go back and do.
Oh, that's really nice. Because I found my own impression of you, you know, from the middle of the violas, I found your certainty terrifying, actually, to start off with. But maybe that's because you were a bit nervous.
My way of coping with nerves.
Yeah. Well, it was absolutely great to have you. We had a great time, and it'd be fantastic if we could do some Offenbach or Massenet with you.
Well, here's hoping. I'm certainly very keen.
Great. Well, thank you very much. That's been a lot of fun and completely broken the mould of all my previous Tea with Nettie, so that's going to be interesting.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you.